Hello and welcome to Red Femme. Hannah and Jen here. Today we're going to talk about the birth rate, the end of humanity, population collapse, celibacy, etc.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was thinking about how, I mean, these things have been thought about before. There is a terrible book by a queer theorist called Lee Edelman, which is for some reason popular, and it's called No Future. And I couldn't really make much sense of it. Now, I remember talking to my PhD supervisor about it, who just said, well, this book just shouldn't have been written. But intelligent people actually looking at the book sort of theorized, like, oh, okay, maybe this is about this possibility of not having children and there being no future. And they linked it to, like, you know, the Kleinian take on the Freudian death drive and blah de blah.
Oh, Christ.
I mean, it was a silly book. It said things like queer is the last cigarette in the packet, or realizing you've run out of cigarettes. And queer is when your dad says he's going to the store for milk and doesn't come back. Anyway, it was just shit. But it was my first introduction to thinking about, oh yeah, if people don't have children, that is actually the end of humanity.
Yeah.
Interestingly. And how many films are about this idea of a big villainous baddie who wants to blow up the world? And then the hero is always saving humanity and stopping this huge explosion or water system poisoning or however it is that the baddie is intending to destroy the world. And anyway, that kind of hysteria or hyperbole or hyperbole, however it's said, is sort of being produced online now regarding the slowing of the birth rate. And it is true, like, the UK, I think Scotland is something like 1.2, England is something like 1.6, Wales is 1.3, and it rounds out at 1.4. So it's dropped below 1.5. Replacement is 2.1. That's the magic number. Even Ireland now, famous for its large Catholic families, is now under 1.5. And, you know, as we've discussed before, the Korean birth rate, South Korean, has dropped from 1.7 to well below 1.5 to now 0.72.
Yeah.
So that in Japan, it's the same. That thing of dropping below one seems to be when governments start to get very worried. And I think that, you know, all global trends are looking that way. Like, the projections are that even countries that are now have very high birth rates in sub-Saharan Africa, that by the turn of the century, they won't be at replacement.
Yeah. Well, the way I've seen it play out over the internet, I haven't been reading the academic literature or ensconced in this debate. Like, this is just my observations from scrolling Twitter, is that originally there was a narrative of women have too high standards, women are delusional, oh, the woman delusion calculator, there's only 0.2 to 4% of men in the world that meet your standards, men are lonely, there's a crisis with men, whatever. And then there was this turn to kind of respectability of, oh, actually, we're not good just beating women with a stick for having standards and, you know, not wanting to be with losers. Actually, this is really a concern about the birth rate. Now, that being said, I'm sure there are people who are genuinely concerned about the birth rate, and it is a problem and it's something to think about and talk about. But it just seems, in the kind of universe of podcasting and online political commentary, yet another stick with which to beat women.
Yeah, I mean, the only people that should be really concerned about the birth rate are really classical economists, because if capitalism is a system that needs to expand and expand, when you no longer have the amount of workers for that expansion, then your system starts to collapse. Indeed, because people think that capitalism just means turning a profit, that you just open a shop and you pay all your workers a good salary, you're on a good salary, and your profits stay, I don't know, let's say you have a 20 grand profit every year that you maybe reinvest, or you just, you know, sits in the bank account as a kind of savings. Actually, under capitalist terms, if your business never grows that profit, but everybody gets paid and your savings increase because it's 20K profit a year, in capitalistic terms, that's a failed business.
Right.
That is a business that is failing. And by the way, that's the majority. Mm. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's great if you can pay people, pay yourself, and, you know, you can have your little mom and pop shop. This idyllic thing in America, this idea that, you know, family-run business. But in capitalist terms, that's negative. And when you then look at inflation over time, it would mean that over time, you are actually paying everybody less and less, unless you increase their wages. And it would mean over time that your savings were not keeping up with inflation. If it was only stayed at 20K a year over a 30-year period, indeed. However, it translates instead to all of these ideas about, yeah, first of all, it was the red pill podcasts that are popular with men saying to very attractive young women, what do you want in a man? They all said at least 5'10", $80,000 a year. So in the top 10% of the income bracket in the UK, that translates to about 50 grand a year. That means you're in the top 10% income bracket, because they were thinking we're in the top 10% of women in terms of beauty.
Yeah. And it's an upper middle class income.
Yes. Yeah.
I would say.
Yeah. And they said, don't want him to be obese. Don't want him to already be married. And I want him to want children. And then they do their little calculations, say, well, did you know that's less than 2% of all men? You're going to be alone. Lower your standards, lower your standards. But that hasn't happened. Women are just saying, oh, well, unless it's going to be worth it for me, unless I'm going to be with a high value man who wants the kind of things I want, treats me well, can also provide for things like a family, like having children, then I'll just be as I am, thank you very much. And I won't bother attaching myself to a man and having children or getting married or whatever. And I think that now the rhetoric about the birth rate is becoming really about the idea that the rest of the world will outbirth the West, and all of this kind of really fantasy fiction hysteria about the West will crumble because we're not replacing ourselves. But in fact, the birth rate around the world is diminishing.
Well, this really speaks to like a contradiction that Marx talked about, right? Which is that businesses want to have low wages in order to increase profits, and the wage market needs scarcity. If you always need a section of people who are unemployed under capitalism to drive down these wages. If everyone had a job, it wouldn't work. But as you drive wages down and continue to produce things, people don't have the money to buy the things.
Yeah.
And then profits fall, and it's this vicious cycle. And how this is being compensated for by neoliberal economists is we'll just do mass migration. This ship people in by the thousands and the thousands and the thousands. And I think the people who are concerned with the birth rate are also people who seem to be very concerned with mass migration. And in their minds, capitalism as a system can continue. We can continue this vicious cycle of profits falling if only women would have more babies. And then we wouldn't have to deal with all the brown people we don't like around us. I think is basically what's being described.
Yes. And I think that it is becoming an inevitable reality, really, because you can't system change very quick, or you can't put the brakes on very quick. So I know the government has now this scheme where you can get, they'll even give you, so you don't just go to the bank for a mortgage, they'll give you a mortgage for a first home that's a new build home. So it's the idea that, you know, we could offer people some security where they could then start a family. Everybody knows if you don't earn a lot of money, it becomes very difficult then to plan a child. Maybe you'll have one by accident, but those people often, as I looked into recently, women are much more likely to have a third and fourth child if they're in social housing and very reliant on tax credits, even though you only get tax credits for the first two.
Yes.
If you're economically inactive, of course, you know, they have the time.
Yeah.
And I'm sure having a child is very meaningful. Mm. So they think, well, you know, not exactly what else am I doing? They've already got kids, but they think it'll be a nice project to have another one. Mm. Those women are much more likely to go on to have a third and fourth. But in terms of who is having the smaller families, only one. Yeah, it's a very middle class thing to just have two children.
Yeah, and I think women are thinking, what exactly do I get out of this? So much of having children, or the quote unquote decision to have children, really wasn't a decision at all. It was just the social norm. It's just what one did when one reached a certain age. You got married and had the children.
And there wasn't birth control until 50 years ago.
And even after the onset of birth control, it remained like a social norm. And also the material reliance that women had on men facilitated a lot of this. And in the West, in the Anglosphere, it doesn't really exist anymore. And this notion that has been ideologically created and inculcated within women, that women are desperate for men, women want men, they read the romance novels and they're obsessed with the romance novels and always the bridesmaid and never the bride, and she's at home and she's, oh, if only she could meet her Prince Charming and the lonely woman with the cats. This sort of narrative, in fact, in 2024, as this is being recorded, the opposite is true. It's male loneliness. It's men living at home. It's men needing to get affection for things that aren't partners. It's men who are socially dysfunctional. It's men who are retreating into fictions about sex and sexuality through pornography and video games and everything. The exact opposite has been true. But has our culture caught up? We still have those ideological notions. Women still, many women, still act as if they're quite desperate for a man. But the real reality, demographically speaking, is that men are in the position of being quite desperate for women. And in fact, it's marriage, you know, is very good for men. It's either neutral for women or a detriment to women in terms of quality of life and length of life. Men need women in this way, at least the way things are socially organized now. And we're heading towards a real crisis. And something you said earlier when we were talking about this is like, it's all stick and no carrot.
Yeah.
They're expecting women to, in a fit of moral guilt and grief and, oh my God, these poor men, to suddenly start getting married and having babies with them. I mean, why?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, punishing people or threatening them into things never really works anyway. The idea that now on the internet, a woman might think, oh, I will be got at by these men who say, you're single and you don't have kids. They just see lots of things online that they would like to do otherwise. Like, I think when the mainstream media could plan ideology, there were all of these rom-coms and Bridget Jones,
yeah.
This idea of the woman with a journalism career, but really she's a sad loser who can't stop thinking about men and losing weight and what wine she's having that day. Young women don't in any way identify with that anymore at all.
No.
And that because of the openness of the internet and it's the nature of it being decentralized, they see various different kinds of women on archetypes almost that they could become, and only one of those is mother and wife.
Yeah, I think TikTok in terms of media has been so paradigm changing in so many ways, in that it's taken away the mystery behind so many lifestyles. You know, before people would write about their lives on Facebook or Twitter or Reddit, or maybe they would put the effort into making a YouTube video and putting on their camera and uploading it. Now you can go and see, what is it like to be a peasant farmer in China? They're on TikTok and watch a video about it. What's it like to work in an oil rig in Texas? I can pull that up on my phone. There's no mystery about the reality of how anyone is living in such a kind of personal way. It's there, to use a disgusting term, lived experience. Though I did do some looking into that lived experience business and I realized why people use it. It has to do with phenomenological research, because there's a difference between the lived experience of the participant and your experience as a researcher. And it was a term to use to differentiate that.
So it was a term from qualitative research to refer to the other's experience.
As opposed to your interpretation of their experience. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you could see all this stuff online and there's no mystery anymore.
Well, look, TikTok's not like Instagram. Instagram is for about nice holiday photos, whereas
yeah.
TikTok is about my thoughts as I'm driving to work as a pediatric nurse.
Yeah.
Or here I am in my normal kitchen showing you how to make a meal for five within 20 minutes.
Yes.
You know.
So women, there is no pastiche. There's no mystery. Like, women are able to see what it's like to be a wife and mother. Women are very honest about the reality of their relationships online. And there's no carrots to be dangled anymore. Women are looking at the carrot and aren't finding it particularly attractive. And just about men, I've met several women and have some close friends who have sons between the ages of, let's say, 14 to 24. I don't know one who isn't in crisis, who isn't not in crisis and kind of like admitted to a psychiatric hospital, doing something actively crazy, but shut down inside, at home, addicted to pornography, not interested in anything, kind of antisocial, disrespectful to people, can't get along socially. I'm sure there are men or in that age range who aren't that way, but it seems to be a huge portion of them. And I think the impulse from the red pill people and the anti-feminist podcasters is to go, well, this is women's fault. You know, women, the natural carers, providers, and nurturers of men, if only you'd open your legs for these men, they wouldn't be that way. And I think that is totally lacks creativity about what's actually caused this problem.
Well, it's also applying that men need the carrot. And women just need the stick.
Exactly.
Whereas I actually think we might need to reverse some of that a little bit, because women are still very interested in men. It's like that Twitter account that's not, you know, particularly left wing or right wing. If anything, it's probably a bit like right wing. Lindy Mann, he literally said to all his, you know, vast majority male following, he said, look, there's women in their 30s that want to get married and have kids.
Yeah.
You just need to step up to be the kind of man they're willing to do that with. Like, but they're out there and they're just sat around waiting for the right man to come along. But that means working on yourself, becoming decent towards women, having a stable job, having a plan of what you want to do in the future. Mm. So if you really want marriage and kids as a man, you know what you have to do to get it. You have to attract a woman. And it's so interesting that they're kind of saying to women, lower your standards, rather than saying to men, just up your standards a little bit. And, you know, Jordan Peterson says it. He says, first of all, women like hygiene.
Yeah.
Make sure you've had a wash. You know, sort yourself out, become disciplined, tidy your room, probably tidy your house when it comes to adult men. You know, give your house a spring clean. Then maybe get a job. Show her that you can be responsible and that you can be committed to something. When he says it, no one has much of a problem, but I don't know how much young men are following that advice.
Yeah, and I think that the analysis of it, it's all leads back to women being women's fault when it's discussed. So another kind of analysis I've seen of this is that these men are like this. The people with this argument will concede there is men who are basically falling way below par in terms of like social expectations or pro-social behavior. But they'll say, oh, it's absent father's fault because they're not there to bring the stick, as we're saying, and it's mothers who have coddled and devoured them. And my thing about that is I don't understand how these people can concede that or say that, which, you know what, hypothetically, let's say that's the case, when the world that they imagine and they seem to promote is exactly the conditions that create a devouring mother.
Yeah.
Have a woman obsessed with her children, never leave the house, have nothing outside of the home going on for her, foreclose that, make her totally obsessed with male approval so she can't say no to her son, can't say no to anybody. That is how you create a devouring mother.
That's how you create a young man who feels like he doesn't need to accomplish anything to have respect and sort of be admired, because he already has a mother who thinks he's the best thing since sliced bread for no particular reason.
Yeah.
And I think that, that sort of little boying of men, because obviously you love children and at that time you don't expect them to accomplish anything. Fine. And you love them, you know, for who they are and they're your own little darling. But then when that man is 21 or 25 or 30, if there isn't someone to say, what the hell are you doing with your life? I also find it interesting that they're trying to use this old sort of ideological kind of chessboard where they say, oh, women, you know, you're unmarried, someone won't marry you unless you're 22 because your eggs are gone, and all of this weird rhetoric. And it's like, look, you're playing on a chessboard from like 1973.
Yeah.
You don't even want to get married. It's men that often don't want to get married. I don't know of any men that want to have children. I've never met one apart from, I have one religious friend.
Yeah.
Other than that, okay, a few other religious boys at uni that I knew. Other than that, men that I know don't want children.
Yeah.
But they think that women do, and that they can play on that in order to have sexual access to women. But the thing is, a lot of women are saying nowadays, I don't need to necessarily do that unless it's going to be a really great version that I basically have a partner that brings something with them, whether it's financial security or other kinds of value. Then I won't bother with that endeavor. I'm okay with my nice job and seeing my friends. And like women who are single, you can see this even in older women. They're so active. It's like even, the local theatre show that we went to.
Yeah.
And almost all of the staff were older, basically women, I think, in their 70s and 80s, volunteering to kind of scan tickets and stuff. And we're having trouble with the scanning app in doing that because they're a bit unfamiliar with new technology. It's like it's women actually that are, if they're single, they live longer. They have better health outcomes. They have more of a social circle. It's single men that all of this is arranged around, but you're not going to manage to in any way anymore bash women into lowering their standards and doing sort of this support system for men that you call marriage and children.
Yeah, it's true. And my understanding is that a lot of this mechanism of getting a woman to be a domestic slave and breeding her basically alone in the home and depriving her of all kind of opportunities outside of that was enforced through the nuclear family, under capitalism at least, because women were very separate from each other, separate from their experience. You were alone in a home with a man and your children. You might see your friends at the PTA or at church on Sunday, but it's a very isolated existence. And then there is that, what that creates is a situation in which a woman thinks it's just her fault because she's individual and she has no one to actually compare and contrast experiences with and say, am I the only one who feels like this? I mean, this is Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique. I think what TikTok has done, I know I keep coming back to TikTok, but social media in general has done is it has bashed down those walls. Women are able to talk to each other. Women are able to see what each other's lives are like. Women are like, oh, that woman went out traveling and she's fine and she's okay. And she chose this career path. And actually that didn't work for her, but it worked. There's all this communication that's happening between women. That whole system has become totally obsolete. And I think it's interesting in so many ways, people have been saying that we're moving to a kind of feudalism. We're transitioning away from capitalism, kind of regressing backwards to a kind of weird techno-feudalism. In feudalism, if Shula Smith Firestone is to be trusted, and maybe people who know more about feudalism and medieval history could let me know and give me some book recommendations, but her understanding of it, at least, was that the family structures were much more diffuse. It was like a community of women taking care of the children, basically. And some of the male children would follow their fathers to work and so on. And there'd be children out and about living in day-to-day lives, not sequestered in these homes or sequestered in schools. And even schools, it's all online now. It's kind of like we're reverting back to this.
Yeah, and just to say about bashing down the walls, I think also women's intra-competition in the heterosexual world also meant that many women are not honest about how terrible their boyfriends or husbands treat them.
Yeah.
Or how kind of rubbish their life is.
Yeah.
And they still see just having a boyfriend or a husband as a form of competition. So a lot of my straight friends will tell me, oh, you're the only friend I have that doesn't just always tell me to break up with my boyfriend whenever there's a problem.
I'm the same. I get the same comment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I go, okay, well, let's actually think about whether you'd want to leave or not. I don't just go, oh my God, he doesn't treat you right, girl. You should definitely cut him off. And they say it's really odd because whenever they have issues with their boyfriends, even when the boyfriend cheats or something worse, they don't want to leave him. But their advice for everybody else is leave. And of course, it's because a lot of women feel better when they're the only one with a boyfriend. as if I'm the one winning in the competition, because and all my friends are just single. So again, it's this idea that you're not succeeding in the race.
Yeah.
And at the end of the race is marriage and kids, or at least having a committed relationship. And I think that, again, social media meant that women could observe other women in their own lives without this field of competition and, and the social relations that go in with that, that are often very mystifying and obscuring. And because I had to tell straight friends of mine that would moan about their pretty decent husbands, they would say, but all my friends, their husbands are angels. They talk about them as if they live for them and they are angels. And I was like, yeah, but that's because they're competing with you. Like, isn't, you know, and they probably used to say it back. I'd be like, the only reason you're even honest with me about what a piece of shit your husband sometimes is because we're not in competition for men because I'm gay.
Yeah.
So it just, yeah, all of that obscuring, all of that essentially lying is the social media has opened these windows into other women's lives, and you don't know really who's observing. But it just means that, yeah, there's no window dressing anymore at all.
No. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there's something about, just a comment on that dynamic of woman complains about boyfriend, another woman tells them to leave them, they don't, and then they reverse roles every fortnight or whatever it is. It's also like, it's like, I always ask, well, what do you want? Do you want to stay or do you want to leave? I mean, barring like criminal abuse or something, I'm like, what do you want to do? And it's like, no one asks them that. And they're like, oh, well, I'd quite like to stay and figure this out. I'm like, okay. But it's so bizarre that the advice is always just leave. And then the woman in the, who's receiving that never goes, oh, but I don't want that.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
It's so weird.
I don't understand it.
It's like
it's a social script.
It's like a communication stopper, because surely the response would be, oh, I don't want to leave him. I know I moan about him, but I really love him and I want to work it out.
Yeah.
And then you go about working it out, however that is. But I've literally got to the point with friends where I've said, look, I've been round this merry-go-round every year with you. The options are, this is usually when they think the husband is cheating. You either accept he's probably cheated and then you either leave because of that, or you accept that he's cheated and you just sort of get over it and try not to think about it anymore. Or you decide he hasn't cheated because you don't have concrete evidence for it, and then you stay and you're over it too. But there aren't more options.
Yeah.
Like, you've confronted him about it. You've got him to swear on the Quran. You've hired a private investigator and paid them $5,000. Like, all of this stuff, I'm like, rather than just doing, like, you actually just need to decide.
Yeah.
Or like, yeah, I don't know. Like, if you've decided, like, that's the thing, that I just get to the point where I'm like, well, if he has kissed another woman, would you leave? No. So why are we having this fucking conversation?
Yeah, I know. And it's so interesting as well how romance in culture and media is like completely dead. Like, there's no representations of it in music anymore. No one writes love songs anymore. They're all songs about nostalgia and like how sad they are or whatever, or songs about being like cynical and nihilistic. And even the romance, the kind of pseudo rom-coms that are being produced now are like, we don't actually want to be together. We're doing like a show and then maybe we accidentally fall in love, but the whole thing is kind of about resentment, or this is an arrangement where I'm paying you to pretend to be whatever. Yeah. There's no When Harry Met Sally, you know, that kind of classic rom-com anymore. And I just think if we go off the base superstructure ideology follows material relations, it's like having the romantic fantasy, it's like a bit like wanting fairies at the end of the garden for young people. I mean, it just doesn't exist as a real possibility anymore because of how constrained all the material relations are.
Yeah. Well, people that are a few generations older also don't realize that the way that dating goes now is you go on a dating app, you hook up, so you have sex. If it goes well and you also quite enjoyed each other's company, as well as having sex, if it works out, you might end up spending time together during the day and doing affectionate things like holding hands. It doesn't go from holding hands and spending time together during the day to sex. It's very much the other way around now.
Yeah.
And as much as that sounds maybe odd, it kind of works in a weird sort of way. And that's just sort of how it is. Whatever our criticism of it, that's how it is. And I think that certainly obliterates the romance thing.
Yes. Yeah, no, I see your point. And even just the reality of using a dating app, like you're shopping for, you know, groceries, it's
very,
or something.
Very ruthless.
So ruthless. And yeah, the way that people talk about prospective partners now, it does, it's like we're returning to kind of an arranged marriage. Maybe not arranged by a church leader or what's matchmaker or whatever, but you're kind of, the thoughts the matchmaker are having are the thoughts that Gen Z are having about themselves.
You're arranging income, it for yourself.
Income, height, family background.
Health.
Health, religion, or are we going to have any problems there? It's like we're returning to that, this idea, this love marriage idea. I think it was Caroline Norma.
On the woman question.
Yeah, she did.
About the demise of love match.
Yeah.
Love match relationships.
Yeah.
That's true. And I think that, I mean, my advice to people is always don't date, just sort of wait to be attracted to someone and then fall in love. But a lot of young people aren't patient enough for that because they're young and they want to have those experiences.
And it's kind of like you can get, it is ultimately quite a selfish society we live in now as well. Like, you can get everything you need and want from your phone.
Yeah.
Sat in a room alone. So it has to be something quite extraordinary to motivate, you know, something as drastic as marriage and children and moving out and the rest of it.
There is a bit of a backlash to that in that some women are now coming off birth control because of the recognition through the internet of so many of its health impacts, right?
This is a perfect example of what we're talking about with the nuclear family walls being
bashed down
and the communication being so open between women.
So there is also a contingent of women who are saying, I'm not going to have sex outside of a committed relationship that would only be with a man that if I got pregnant, he'd either support me through an abortion or support me with a child. And there's very, again, it makes women very, I guess the word is filtering. And having very particular high standards of, you know, does this man really like me? It's like the FDS podcast, the female dating strategy podcast, says, don't have sex with a man for 6 months, because that basically is about whether he's really, really interested in you to the point that he may pursue marriage. Like, he's thinking that long term, because I don't know many men that would wait that long, but I also don't know any men that want to get married.
Yeah, it's like, basically, these people who are very concerned about this, they're like pulling every lever that is like kind of shame based.
Yeah.
And there doesn't seem to be any sort of like, I don't know, something called planning.
Yes,
you know,
social planning.
Social planning, economic planning. Turns out if you have a totally unstable system based on a false premise that collapses every 5 to 8 years, it's not the best thing for people to feel secure.
Yeah.
But there's no thoughts about any planning. And yeah, those comments about, you know, the welfare state is bad for birth rates. I was like, what is actually meant by that? And then I kind of followed up with it and read some more. And the argument is basically, if there is an NHS or a public healthcare system, when you're old, you're taken care of by the state. Therefore, you don't need children to take care of you when you're old. I mean, I can't imagine a more bleak, horrible motivation to have children.
I know.
Like, it's so, what's the word?
Morbid?
Morbid. That's exactly it. It's so morbid. And like, also, is this what we want? Like, we don't, you know, we kind of realized that perhaps geriatric patients and elderly people need actually pretty high quality care in a regulated environment or by regulated people who have professional standards. Do you want, this is why middle-aged people are the unhappiest between the ages of like 35 and 50 or whatever, because they're taking care of their kids and they're taking care of their parents. Is this what we want? Like, some weird shame-based obligation to do work you're not qualified or equipped to do and have no life because of it? I mean, it's just a really, really morbid reason to have children.
Just to say, those were Louise Perry's comments.
Yes.
I can't remember where, but it was on a clip. And I think that, also, I don't understand. It's like, okay, Louise, so you're planning to just have daughters?
Yes.
Are you planning to do sex selection IVF?
Yeah.
Because that's not very available, apart from, I believe, in Mexico, Cyprus, and America. And just because that's not an expectation put on sons, it's an expectation put on daughters. I'm also very aware, because I've met them, a lot of women aren't very good at care work.
No.
I've seen, enough friends of mine who are mothers shoving spoonfuls of rice into their baby's mouths as the child screams and they don't think to comfort them for a second. And then I've watched macho dad come home and do a much better job with the baby.
Yeah.
But he's not going to be the one who the expectation falls on. The idea that your children will even be good at looking after you, or just the daughters, are you planning to put those daughters through nursing school? Are they going to be in healthcare? Like, it's a very strange idea to go, we need to get rid of the welfare state so that women are dependent on husbands and then dependent on the children. That's a very big gamble that you're running with women's lives.
That they're not going to want to take. It's also this completely faith-based sort of delusional hallucination that is so impenetrable with these people that sex role stereotypes are evolutionarily ingrained, genetically ingrained, that every person is like a perfect walking sex role stereotype. And if you're not, that means that there's something wrong with you and you're repressed. Of course, it's absolutely evidence-free zone. There's absolutely no evidence for it whatsoever. But that is the core, very rigid, very inflexible belief that absolutely cannot be challenged. And I just come back to Rad Fem Hitler's point, and it's a point I'm sure that's been made many times, then why do you need to ideologically enforce it?
Yeah.
Why are you on podcasts trying to shame women into having children and taking care of their parents? If it's natural, you don't have to teach a dog to bark. They just do it. If it's completely ingrained and ordained by some huge evolutionary force that is completely inescapable and determinist, why do you need to be shaming women on podcasts?
Yeah, why can't we have a welfare state?
Yeah.
Why can't we have one then?
Yeah.
Because surely that's not going to offset this natural need, this natural compulsion that women will have.
Yeah.
We can have all of this social infrastructure.
Yeah.
Given that apparently this tendency is not social at all, it's natural.
Yeah, exactly.
So what are you worried about? It's because we all actually know it's fucking social.
We all know it's social. Like, let the drag queens teach your kids, Louise Perry. Give them to a daycare center full of queer activists. It's all natural and ingrained in evolutionary psychology. Yeah. It's all going to happen anyway. These people all know social reproduction is real. It's why they're trying to do it all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Also, even just the cues of femininity, again, I've seen friends of mine that are mothers, you were not friends anymore if you could guess, like full face of makeup, full pink outfit, hijab, carrying a baby with 5 coats on it. The baby is red. The baby is panting like a dog. And I've said, I think your son might be a bit hot. No, he's fine. Well, he's turning red and he's panting, so maybe he's hot. And then the mother went, oh yeah, he's not breathing. I think his lungs have collapsed. Starts ripping the baby's clothes off. I'm like, well, we've just watched him for several minutes turn red and pant with his tongue out like a dog. You didn't see those signs? Femininity doesn't make people smart. It doesn't make people observant.
No.
Taking your face in makeup and lacquering your hair or covering it in a hijab or wearing high heels or stapling high heels to your ears as, earrings. It doesn't make you good with children.
No.
And I find it so bizarre that we would think that even half the population are somehow compulsively feminine and are good with children. Lots of them aren't. You just think they are. And I want to give another example. Mm-hmm. Another friend of mine who basically was like an au pair, but like a nanny, that was it. She was like a posh nanny and she had like a big bosom, matronly bosom. And she was sort of dressed like a middle-aged woman, despite being a young woman. And she had the vibes. She had the nanny vibes. This woman I happen to know, the entire time looking after this posh man's children, his wife had sadly died, was high. She smoked cannabis from morning till night. But every single person, 99 out of 100 people, would have her look after their children than me.
Yeah.
A anti-drugs lesbian, because we all know social reproduction is real and she conforms to some gender stereotypes, apart from only wafer thin ones. because I would never be on drugs. I'd never be on drugs anyway, but certainly not in the care of children, right?
Yeah.
So all of this is so, even all the signs of masculinity and femininity, I mean, it is all just symbolic. Mm. And it often doesn't symbolize anything meaningful underneath.
Yeah.
Like thinking it's not good to be high as a kite whilst looking after infants.
Yeah. No, it's incredible. I guess they would say, what would they say to something like that? They would say something like, but that's an aberration, or there's something kind of pathological about that, and that women should be oriented kind of back to this natural order. But then I'm like, what is the mechanism here of why that happens? Like, why is there indeterminacy in the system? If it's as simple, if it's in the brain, hardwired in the brain, genetically hard, biologically hardwired in the brain, I mean, you don't have to tell your heart to beat. You don't have to ideologically invest in your food being digested in your stomach. Why do you need to ideologically enforce this?
They probably think that because it's behavior, that ideologically, there's an ideological disruption from the state apparatus, like institutions like the welfare state, the NHS, so on, so on.
Yeah.
So they think that that can be disrupted. And why they want to get rid of the state institutions is then there will be no disruption to this natural aptitude.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, them saying it's an aberration, I can't find the person who is actually the genuinely the stereotype of the happy housewife mother who's good at it. I can't actually, I can't find an example.
Yeah.
Every mother, all right, everybody makes mistakes. Everybody maybe, I don't know, alienates their teenage children for a while because that's what teenagers are like. Or maybe it's your fault as a parent, who knows? I can't find this example of the rosy nuclear family.
No.
Of which there used to be models on films. And now if you know, no one's really going to the cinema anymore. People are watching Netflix. It does reflect reality in that most families are reconstituted.
Yeah.
Most families have someone who's been divorced already. Most children now statistically are accidents.
Yeah.
They didn't plan to have children at all. They just got pregnant. The woman got pregnant and decided not to have an abortion. So it's never going to work to try and dial things back to 1953, where you were a miserable trad wife, your husband was gay, and your children hated you.
Also, I'll retake that for the end. Also, in the post-war period, guess what there was? Planning. They had like a massive income tax rate. There was a huge amount of social planning and state intervention that made that happen. It's this naturalist, it's a fundamental philosophical flaw, and in my view, a fundamental philosophical difference, that what is natural is, quote unquote, is natural, is what is normative. What is normative is therefore good. If we orientate everything to what is quote unquote natural as defined by these people, then things will be good. And if there's an aberration on that, that needs to be corrected. And there's this kind of force, and a lot of it is religious. A lot of it, there's this force that will orientate things to the good. In fact, that's a lot of what like Catholic sexual ethics are about, or Catholic ethics are about, is like, let's orientate things naturally, so therefore it's good.
But I would say in the past it worked backwards, where what was good for capitalism was then considered normative, which was then decided to be natural. But the problem is today, because of the economic downturn, since the end of the 1960s, basically, which is why they had to invent financialization, you have needed men and women in the workforce.
Yeah.
It used to be that a man could just have a job and provide for a family, and the woman supported him and raised the children as future workers. If the sons were going to be workers, the girls were going to be wives. Today, our economy is not sustainable with that, and neither is just living.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, what man can afford a wife and three children? None of them, you know, the wife doesn't never works.
You know, and let's say you and I and women who agree with us, feminists, whatever, were to go, fine, what can we do to increase the birth rate? And these people said, we got to support the family. I said, okay, we'll support the family. We're with you there in this hypothetical. What do we need to do that? What do you want? What is the solution
well,
here?
Well, all of the things that I would suggest are about the women, because it's women who have babies. And then they don't like that because it excludes the father.
Yeah.
There is a tension between fathers, the rule of fathers, and the state. Because what would I do? I'd basically give a salary for 3 years for a woman to have a kid.
That's right.
Till it pops off to school or nursery. I'd say, you know, we'll give you a basic salary. In Hungary, they said to women, if you have X amount of children by Y age, you don't have to pay income tax for the rest of your life. Again, that's very in the future. I don't think young people today, given how unstable the world is, are making decisions in the long term.
Mm.
Because it's just, I mean, young people aren't very like this anyway, but it's also, you know, it's just, it's so unreliable. So I would do the more immediate ones. In Philadelphia, they started giving $1,000 a month to pregnant women. So you get basically 10 grand, just under, which in America pays for your birth.
Yeah.
It is about 10 grand to give birth. But again, so what they really, they don't want more state provision, even though that would help. They, maybe Louise Perry won't articulate it because it would be so obviously anti-feminist. But what they want is sort of for the state, I think, to remove support for women so that there's an increased dependency on men.
Yeah.
But then that won't mean that economically men can support women in our current phase of history.
Yeah, and with all the problems we've listed with men developmentally that are going on at the minute.
Yeah. Not graduating to be noble, respectable patriarchs, staying in the adolescent phase of video games and porn.
Yeah. No, you're 100% right. They don't like that state provision basically gives women some material freedom from men. This is why a lot of feminists support like universal livable income or universal basic income, about giving women some material freedom away from men. And they're just returning to the old tactics that they think will work, which is like social shaming. And it's just really not very convincing. Ultimately, it's reactionary. It's just a reaction. They aren't actually proposing anything other than this kind of, I don't know, reinstating of like shame-based social control of women. And I'm sorry, if you are concerned about the birth rate, let's pretend we're all concerned about the birth rate. It's just simply not an effective strategy. It's just not going to work.
Yeah. Well, I've always, it's one of the reasons that, I mean, in some respects, climate change gives me some relief because I think, wow, the world won't exist in a few hundred years. And I really do think the human experiment has been that bad that we don't necessarily deserve to go on. And so I'm not very concerned about the birth rate. I don't care if there's a crisis in capitalism. In fact, I think good.
Yeah, same, to be honest.
It's showing up the system for what it is. And if, you know, we are essentially culling a generation or generations of people, and it's due to the exacerbations of neoliberalism. And I just think, well, this is what you wanted. This is what you get. You get the market ripping through everybody's lives. So there we are.
Yeah.
But if I do put myself in a position where I think, okay, we've really got to drum up some children for the future to be our essential workers, I would basically take things like the concept of the mommune and be like, you get housing if you're a woman, you move to this particular place and you raise your children in a kid-friendly environment amongst other mothers and maybe a couple of dads. And it's all overseen. There's lots of oversight because I'm always worried about things descending into cults. You know, there's oversight, there's legislation, there's support, there'll be schools and nurseries there, there'll be fun things to do, whatever. And this idea of a modern mommune. But the fact is, that would be the welfare state.
Yeah.
So,
no, you can't really escape some social planning, basically.
No.
And I think all this has come up. I also wanted to talk about nationalism, because that's sort of relevant to this whole thing through immigration and, oh, what's going to happen to Britain, or what's going to happen to America, or what's going to happen to South Korea when people aren't having babies. And globalization, which conservatives fully paved the way for with deregulation, financialization. You wanted a free market. Free market. You got it. You got it. This is it. Careful what you ask for. People, the idea of the nation state is like barely relevant in the minds of anybody, you think you're going to motivate people this way, like do it for the future of England or do it for the future of South Korea. I mean, the whole thing is completely irrelevant. Most people have friends all around the world in different time zones that they're talking to all the time. They work from home. They're, you know, they're paid in Bitcoin. Like, what are you talking about? As if this is relevant. And I think Tim Dillon is right. What it's going to start doing is it's going to start descending into basically little communities of people with shared values that really, and the idea of the nation state is basically on its way out. You asked for this.
It is quite crazy though, that if you look at America and Canada and our birth rate, I can't remember the exact figures, but it's gone down within half a decade, about 0.2 to 0.3. If that continues, we will be below one sort of in the 2030s at some point.
Yeah.
And I think we are moving to a society where 50% of people don't have children.
Yeah.
And I personally think that's fine.
Well, this is the thing. I'd have to read more about antinatalism. I don't really know very much about it. But I'm just like, if the population was to significantly drop, I guess they say that there is a collapse of social institutions that would arrive from that. But I mean, as we've established, that's basically already the case. So what could, you know, what's the, well, I guess we don't have no one to take care of the boomers, and that's quite morally troubling.
You know, like a couple decades ago, people were worried about overpopulation.
Yeah, it's been debunked now.
Yeah. But, and now people are worried about the future underpopulation. And I just think, honestly, it's fine if there were half the people on the planet that there are now. This is the, there are more people on the planet now than in all of history combined. You know that?
Yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, I don't think it's bad or good, but I'm just saying it's a crazy fact that there are more people alive now than have been alive in all of history altogether.
Yeah.
It's nuts. Because it used to only be 1 million, 10 million, 100 million, however many. And you just think, okay, well, I, you know, I don't think there's anything natural or unnatural about it, or sustainable or unsustainable. I just sort of feel like, look, you know, if you are recognizing finally actually women are really important to the economy, oh well, I'm glad you woke up to it. Maybe start paying them. Like, I support wages for housewives, a salary to have a child. And if you're thinking it's not important, well, let's look at Japan in 80 years and you can tell me it's not important.
Yeah. Also, a lot of it's a sunk cost fallacy thing as well, in that a lot of people make decisions based on social shame and the need for social conformity, and are quite maybe affronted by the fact that other people won't do the same. And there is something interesting in that connection between antinatalism, or what we're talking about, who cares if the population collapses, and like environmentalism and that whole connection that goes on, especially within radical feminism. I'm thinking of like deep green resistance. I think they take it a bit far. But myself, but this idea that to conquer climate change, which is real, by the way, like I can't abide this nonsense that it's not real. It's like, you know, Trump derangement syndrome for conservatives. Like, it's clearly the case. To fight climate change, we all need to be feminists, to lower the birth rate. When women are educated and emancipated and have the vote, they have less children, they get more education, they contribute more to the economy, and that might be what is needed to tackle climate change.
Yeah, they do say the number one thing to lower your carbon footprint is to not reproduce. But I don't really know if anyone is really getting their norms from their politics. I think they're actually more gravitating towards politics based on their values.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But I think one of the biggest things is, men are already less sensitive to social norms. I want women to be less sensitive to social norms. I don't mean norms in terms of like sexual degeneracy. I think it's good that people aren't sexual degenerates. I think it's good that people, that, you know, that we have a certain shame around drug use or violence or things like that. But in terms of how hyper aware and riddled with self-abasement and insecurity, particularly young women are, about not being seen to socially conform, I do think that's a bad thing. And I want more women to think, oh, well, I'm just, you know, that's not for me. And be able to say, well, my values aren't your values. I'm not bothered about whether I have kids or not. Maybe it'll happen or maybe it won't. Because in the past, that was really just the expectation. And, you know, it's so odd. I've had friends of mine just when I've said, oh, you know, don't know whether I will have kids or not. And they've said, but everyone has children. I'm just like, what are you talking about? One in four women already don't have children. It's soon going to be one in two. Like, just these kind of comments where it's like, okay, so what you're saying is I should go and get knocked up now, right away. What? Like, what is even this advice?
Yeah, that's one negative thing I would say about TikTok and the internet and globalization and the rest of it. Just speaking about young women being concerned with social norms, Sheila Smith Firestone talks about how the function of trends in terms of like beauty standards and beauty rituals and so on. And she says that the purpose of them basically is to make it easier for women to be stereotyped as a class. If you all look the same, then you all must act the same, that sort of thing. And it is quite incredible how beauty trends are now kind of international and over the internet. There are still some regional differences, but not really anymore. And the ideal, like, face is not possible without cosmetic surgery because it's Asian eyes, a white person nose, black person lips, and like a Latin American skin tone.
Yes.
It's like the stereotype has become global. It's being mixed race in a way that nobody is mixed race. And it's really interesting how this has gone beyond regional differences through the internet.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. Well, the internet has also brought many things. Like, we always talk about it, that the internet has made people realize Americans aren't very smart sometimes.
It's made people, let's go over the things.
And that British people are not very attractive.
That, yeah. Americans are not smart, like, don't know basic things about, like, where countries are, how to spell things, like, really kind of things that would be quite shocking in other countries. Yeah. British people have quite interesting ideas about beauty and grooming. And also, the food is something that Americans find horrifying.
Well, we like it.
I like it. What other stereotypes have emerged?
That India's not the best place to live.
That India's not the best place to live or the best place to travel, especially as a woman.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, a lot of mysteries being illuminated.
Well, people are basically interacting with each other in a way they weren't before.
Yeah.
And yeah, I didn't know till a few years ago the stereotype was that British women weren't good looking. I was like, oh. And then I thought, oh, yeah.
Yeah. What it is like the American archetype for like attractive woman is the all-American girl next door who's like sporty and natural and she's a server at church and she's beautiful and whatever.
But she's got a wide jaw with good teeth.
Yeah, she's got, yeah, wide jaw, looks like corn fred, very like, you know, health related.
And if you look at other settler countries that were settler societies and then graduated from that, Australia,
yeah,
also women are much better looking than,
because all the ones with like not great genetics died
exactly
on the way to the frontier. Yeah,
exactly.
Whereas British beauty standards are very much about effort.
Yeah.
And like, are you attractive kind of by effort? So it's really more of like a display of how much effort you've put in. It's almost like the end result is not considered. You know what I mean?
Yes, I should say there are some very smart Americans. And in fact, they have the best higher education system in the world.
Oh, of course.
But the general populace does not seem to be being delivered a very good standard of education.
I think it's that No Child Left Behind thing.
But wasn't that good?
No, it lowered the standards.
Oh, right.
Because the idea was No Child Left Behind, we're not going to fail anyone.
So we're just going to...
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
I mean, we don't have, in my opinion, the best education system here, but America's, a friend of mine, just anecdotally, went to visit her cousins in LA and she snuck into school with them. They didn't really have registers. She just hung out with her cousins in school. And she said the English class was basically read one of these books if you fancy it.
Yeah.
And music class was watching MTV Bass.
No, because Americans are so individualistic.
Oh, and this, just to say, this was the good school. She was like, this is where all the white, suburban, middle-class kids went.
Yeah, like, Americans are so individualistic that some of the kind of Victorian authoritarian things here would be like a lawsuit, a national news story, something like parents would, I don't know what they would do, like probably physically assault someone. Like, it's not a conceivable idea. Even the uniform thing, which I support and think is great, actually, like don't tread on me.
Yeah.
Like, pursuit of my happiness. I'm an individual. How dare you tell me what to wear? It would just never happen.
I agree with the American. I mean, I'm very individualistic. So I grew up in the West consuming a lot of American media that I loved. So I actually think I agree with them because I think we make our kids look very weird in their school uniforms.
I'm in favor of school uniforms, but I just think it needs to be like a t-shirt and some trousers.
It should be a polo shirt and some joggers or trousers or something. It shouldn't be an awkward suit with an awkward tie for children.
And it's like the idea behind that, I think, was preparing them for the workforce, but no one wears that to work anymore.
And every day when I was at school, you had your ears checked to see if you had earrings in. Every day.
I mean, what? I had this conversation actually with an American, and it was about the having your hair down and the ear piercings in. And she was like, oh, but it's a safety thing. And I was like, there was no incident of any kind at any point in my education that there was a problem with hair being down and earrings. We had a strict rule about the chemistry lab, so your hair didn't like literally set on fire and you'd have to take earrings out for gym class. But what are you talking about? Safety? Are women being assaulted?
It's a hangover from British Victorian culture and the way that it's applied to children, because children are the most powerless people in society, that the hangover is mainly on them today. This arbitrariness. I knew a boy at school. He dyed his hair blonde. He was suspended.
Yeah.
He had to dye it back, but he was suspended until it was gone and already like for a week as punishment. I knew boys that would have their hair in a fro, naturally. I saw staff members chase them into assembly and say, you need to change your hair. This is like a racist incident.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And I don't know what he made his hair so it wasn't such an afro, but it was like even boys having short hair.
Yeah.
Your hair was too short. You got suspended from school.
Yeah.
I mean, what were they going to do? Get hair extensions? Like, it is crazy the amount that children are arbitrarily policed with this weird collective Victorian vision. I much prefer the American model of wearing Yeezy slides to school.
I mean, not to be a liberal about it, but I am a liberal in a couple of areas, and I think this is one of them. I think it really is a balance thing, because I had a very liberal education in Canada, like supremely liberal. No one gave a shit if I showed up or didn't show up. No one gave a shit if I walked out of class at any point that I wanted to. No one gave a shit if I handed anything in. No, there was no expectations. And I think that's a part of the reason why there is such a much higher dropout rate out of university in the United States compared to here. Because you guys kind of filter the people out who aren't going at the A-level level, but you're just passed through. And I think that sends a message to kids like, A, this isn't important. Like, it's not important to know about the world around you. Intelligence isn't important. Education as a value is not important. And it sends the message that we don't give a shit about you.
Yes.
So I think it's a balance. I find that some of the stories I hear from friends who went through the British school system, it just sounds weirdly, almost sexually sadistic.
It is.
And
it's sexually sadistic and sort of fascistic and weird.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not kidding. Like, I enjoyed my university life. I have a fucking PhD. School in this country is a horrible experience.
Yeah.
And it just shouldn't need to be.
No.
It's so not conducive to encouraging children to continue in education, to make it hell for them whilst they're there.
Yeah. And there is also a weird cultural thing that I think we have it a bit in Canada too. I think it might be a UK Canada versus US thing, but you definitely have it more here of it's not cool to have hobbies or interests.
Oh yeah, we do. Once you hit puberty as a teenager.
Whereas like school sports are huge. All the different clubs, mathletes, the scholastic competitions, the whatever, like it's a huge
thing. Here it's that if you care about something, you're sad. You're a sad bastard, and that you should be being cynical in a park, just sort of smoking and trying to get away with it and saying, oh, all of that, it's shit. Why are you so sad? Why do you care? It's the idea of like, if you care about anything, We almost like if you care about something, it's ammunition we could use against you. And therefore, that's really why kids, I think, drop caring about anything when they're a teenager in terms of hobbies or interests. But it's the idea you're sad.
I mean, this could be, it's just an anecdotal experience of mine. It could be explained by other things I hadn't thought of. But I definitely notice many more teenagers loitering around doing nothing in the UK compared to Canada. Definitely notice that a lot more. There's not a lot of, I like being on public transit and then just being accosted by like a group of 15 to 20 teenagers. Like, it's bizarre. I'm like, where, why, what are you doing here? It's not an experience I really had so much.
Well, surely if they're on a bus, they're on their way somewhere. But the point is, you take over the space and you're very loud.
You're very loud. And sometimes they're not.
I was that teenager as well.
Sometimes they're not on buses. They're in other kind of like public areas. And I'm like, what is happening? There were kids that did that, but they were like the bottom of the bottom of the bottom of the bottom of the bottom social hierarchy kids who were like literally very much on the bottom end of the hierarchy. We would call them the skids.
Yeah.
But
in America, the sports are taken more seriously. Teen high school sports, it's not here at all, really. And you kind of have to have parents that are middle class, probably, or at least own you a car and can run you around to different activities to occupy. But anyway, let's get back to the birth rate. I just want to make a clarifying point before we end, which is the research I did on the 4B movement in South Korea that we actually did a Patreon episode on just a few days ago. There is a misunderstanding that 4B is a response, really, I think, to the ideological backlash on the internet and in society that's aimed at women. It's to say you need to have children. So in South Korea, there was the Sampo generation in the early 2010s that were people giving up on courtship, marriage, and children. That's what Sampo kind of refers to. And then I think that continued. And in some of the backlash, I think, politicized women into being feminists, and that created 4B, that then also produced the final rule of no sex. So no sex with men, no marriage, no children, and no dating. But I think that when we see 4B arriving on TikTok now in the West, it is, again, a lot of women are saying, oh, well, if you think we're all hoes, if you think we're just mindless thoughts, you won't mind if we just walk away then. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that it's produced by material conditions, and then 4B is a reaction to the kind of ideology that they're trying to clamp down and say, oh, you know, even if no one can afford to have kids anymore, you should do it anyway. Otherwise, you're a hoe. Why do you want to be single forever? Why don't you want to be a respectable woman and be married and have kids? And then women go, oh, right, well, if you just think I'm a whore, I guess you won't mind if I close my legs.
Yeah.
And I'm unavailable and I don't want to, and I'm at home being celibate. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it all comes down to material conditions, and those aren't changeable very fast. Unless, the government literally starts handing out money to women on the basis of producing a child.
Oh, it's just going to take huge social planning. And I do think capitalism is accelerating to, I won't say a collapse, but we're basically, the American empire is ending. We're moving to a multipolar world. You know, the US is not really going to be able to sustain itself and their failing economic system, capitalism, through foreign wars for very much longer, because they're not going to be able to beat them or sustain them long enough, because sort of the model has been, we go into a country, we ruin it basically, and then we pay ourselves to fix it. That model is not going to be able to be sustainable much longer now that Russia and China and Iran and the BRICS system and everything is, you know, taking over basically, or creating a multipolar world. We are starting to see developments. And I think that the only way that this problem of the birth rate, if you consider it a problem at all, is fixable is through planning and through the end of neoliberalism, which I think might be, who knows, sometime soon.
I think they might start planning after decades of the birth rate being below one. But then the problem is to reverse the trend takes generations and generations for you to then have, again, like a population back to what it was 100 years before.
Yeah, but there's only so much planning you can do within a neoliberal model.
Well, I'm saying that even if I'm saying that will change because right. they have to do this sort of planning,
yeah.
and that will probably mean that that's highly compromised.
Yeah,
almost like, I mean, China gets it right really with their market and social planning model.
Yeah,
everybody thinks that's communism. It's actually capitalism and communism combined in a particular way, right?
Yeah,
and I think that. The thing is once you have wiped out the generations of people who were never born that might have been, who then aren't having the children, the ones that remain have to have a lot more children to go back to just where you were 100 years ago. Or governments could just accept that they have half the population they used to. Or I think it's at the end of the century, Japan has said, oh no, it's by 2080 that they'll have 30% less people. You can just decide that's fine. But that's not fine if you want to have a capitalist economy.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
That is the difference, yeah.
So I think it's fine. It doesn't mean you can't have a sustainable capitalist economy, though, from now till then.
Well, that's it. Like, if you don't have the scarcity in the wage market, it's very difficult. It becomes more difficult to drive down wages. And Japan is an interesting case in that they're refusing to do mass migration to, quote-unquote, fix it.
Yeah.
Whereas that seems to be the direction that a lot of the...
But even though we're doing that, I read something the other day that Turkey has a larger economy than the UK now. And you just wow.
That guy who... Was it a Chinese ambassador to the UK or some such diplomat or official was speaking to, I think, an LBC presenter. And the LBC presenter...
Oh, no, it was BBC.
It was a BBC.
Yeah.
A BBC presenter who said, what is China going to do with... could do to compete with the UK.
Oh my god, so embarrassing.
And the guy was just like, oh, we're not competing with you, you're not on the playing field, there is absolutely no competition to be had. It was just humiliating, and the guy looked so ashamed. I'm like, why would you ask?
Well, he just said the UK doesn't produce anything anymore. China is about to become the largest car producer. It's about to be the leading in EV technology, whatever that is.
Yeah.
And just started rattling off these different figures and said, so, you know, what the UK should do with China is not be an enemy of China.
Yeah.
And we should cooperate where we can, but we don't see you as a competitor. How could they?
Well, the guy whose name I can never remember, it must be an unconscious thing. I think I reference this book like every second podcast and I can never remember the man's name. Anyway, guy who wrote Super Imperialism, who talked about how the US controls financial markets in a way that suits their interest. He said, basically what China is doing is what America did in the 20th century, which is to ramp up domestic production and sell it globally and become a manufacturing center, which is what the US was until recently. The Chinese are just doing what the Americans did to become a superpower in the 20th century.
Yeah, the author's name is Michael Hudson.
I can never remember it. I have no...
Well, it's a pretty boring name. Yeah, even China, you know, it gets told or said that they are doing soft imperialism in developing Africa, right? Sub-Saharan Africa, particularly those countries. But like the EFF are welcoming it. Lots of the economies are welcoming it. A friend of mine went to Gambia recently and apparently there's one road, proper road, from the airport to the beach. And she said, oh yeah, the Chinese built it. Good.
Yeah, I mean, and what comes with IMF loan, like the alternative for those places are like IMF loans and debt restructuring through, you know, the International Monetary Funds, big infusions of money from like charities and aid donations and so on. And it's just been a disaster. It just hasn't worked for them at all.
Yeah.
It just hasn't worked for them at all. Why would they be interested in that model? And that's the other thing. They were forced into that model by the super imperialist structure and with threats of sanctions. If you don't do what we say and you try to have some economic independence, we will starve you to death.
Which is what happened in Venezuela.
Which is what happened in Venezuela and has happened in Yugoslavia, happened in Vietnam, happened in Cuba. It's what they do for anyone who wants to do anything different. And now that we live in a multipolar world and we have BRICS and we have everything, those countries can... do business with someone who's not you. You don't own the show anymore. And it's going to be fascinating to see how that all... It really is an end of an empire.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Also, China, they're not just going to invade if you say no.
No.
They actually seem interested in the economic development of that country. because it's in their interest, sure.
Yeah.
But they're not planning to just plunder the place, then skip off.
No. So. Well, the model is for the US is we go in, you cooperate with our privatization and our financialization and our investments and our IMF loans and our aid and our whatever, our control over your government, whatever. And if you don't, we'll sanction you. And then countries who want to do nationalization or want to do whatever else, it's will invade you. And it's not ideologically popular anymore to do the, we'll take over your capital, plant our flag, we're doing colonialism. They, or we're doing a straightforward coup. They did that in Latin America, propped up all these fascists. Big PR nightmare, you could say. So what the plan is, and is actually more profitable, is you go in and you systematically destroy every institution. You fund factioning groups. You take real people with legitimate concerns against the government, and you fund them and you make them militias and you train them. You get all these groups fighting each other. Then you go in as the peacemakers and pay yourself to rebuild it. And that's what they did to Syria. That's what they did to Iraq. That's what they did to Libya. That's what they did to Somalia. It's regime change through basically sowing chaos and destroying a state.
Yeah. It's what they did in Somalia.
Yeah.
What they've done in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
The list just goes on and on.
Yeah.
I mean, when I would read those statistics of the America invaded over 50 countries in the last century alone, I'd be like, huh, there'd just be a lot of names on that list.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, good chat about the birth rate.
Went off a bit there, but we're having a fun time having a chat.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening. And let us know your thoughts about how we're going to up the birth rate. And if you'd like to support us or listen to bonus episodes, we are on Patreon, patreon.com/redfemme.
Where we do an extra bonus episode every Thursday.
Yes. All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.